This is Joe Orso, and we're here on Conversations today with my good friend, Saul Prombaum. And Saul Prombaum is an old friend from La Crosse. He's the rabbi at Congregation Sons of Abraham. And today, we're going to talk about stories.
Well, thank you, Joe. Nice to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. And the reason I called Saul to talk about this is because I remember the first time that I called you was in 2006. I was working at the newspaper in La Crosse, and I remember in that conversation, one of the first things you said to me was, "Let me tell you a story." And I forget the story, but I remember you saying that. And since then, we've become friends, and you've spent time with my family. And one of the things that Adrienne, my wife, and I talk about a lot is how much you've taught us about stories and storytelling, and how much we appreciate in our conversations your ability to open up space through stories. And so that's what I want to explore today.
Well, thank you.
And I thought we could just start by maybe if you could talk a little bit about how, I don't know if you think of yourself as a storyteller, but I do, and how you became a storyteller, and how stories kind of evolved in
sure.
your life.
Well, here's the thing. If you're a preacher's kid, the way I am, stories come naturally because at the heart of every sermon is a story, whether it's a biblical story or a story, a personal anecdote, or some other story that backs up the message that you're trying to make. Every sermon is a story. And so I grew up in that culture, and the holy books that I was exposed to had all these stories in it. And so it was just a natural thing to move beyond knock-knock jokes into something a little deeper.
Well, so let's talk about that a little bit, the religious dimension. So one thing that I've noticed when you tell stories is that a lot of times I've heard those stories growing up, the ones from the Bible, but when I encountered them growing up, a lot of times they felt dead mm-hmm. or meaningless.
Sure.
And there have been times where you've told me the same story that I've heard, you know, countless times. But when you've told it, it sort of cracked open and became alive in a way that I didn't even think was possible. So how does that happen?
Well, let me tell you, there is a way of storytelling that is called midrash. And what it means is search, inquiry. It is basically going into a subject that the storyteller has a question about. So, for example, there's a famous book, it's been out a few years now, by Anita Diamant. It's called The Red Tent. And it's the story of Dina, who was the daughter of Jacob, who has 12 brothers. And she's a pivotal figure. Her abduction, quote unquote, by a local Canaanite, and her being saved by her brothers, never to be seen again, after Shimon, Simeon, and Levi massacre the town that she was taken to, she is gone. I mean, she's just gone from the story. What happens to Dina? And this led Anita Diamant to tell the story of how she felt about what happened to her, and by way of doing that, telling the story of women's culture at that time as the author and as we know from history and oral traditions.
So what makes a story work and what makes a story not work?
What makes a story work is if the subject is interesting to the person who is listening to it. And so you'll find that all the great stories have something in common. They're either about an interesting person, usually, or someone, let's say you're telling a story to a child, someone their age. It is usually about a person meeting a challenge and overcoming an obstacle to get to the other side. Not always happily, like we have in the Hollywood films, but people are most interested in the lives of other people, real or not, you know. So we build our stories around the experiences, fictional or non-fictional, of other people.
What's the importance or role of stories in Jewish culture?
The purpose of the story. So let's get back to this thing called Midrash.
Okay.
If you are attempting to interpret a story, what Midrash gave you the license to do is as follows. I'm going to tell you a story, and the story is going to have a message in it, and you're going to say, well, what is the message that you're leaving me? The message is there's a question that needs to be answered. Does the story that I've just told you answer a question? And if you say it does, which question do we just answer? Let me give you an example. There's a story that comes from the creation of the first human being. It says that God put a tail on Adam, looked at it, and took it off, and the story ends, for the sake of human dignity. Now, what the heck is this story about? Why is there a story about a human being having a tail and then not having a tail? So if you, depending on who's in the room, a person might say, well, you know, the human skeleton has the remnant of a tailbone. It's called the coccyx, right? So did we ever have tails? Or do we just have this little nub that is left over from God's attempt to create another animal with a tail, but this one called the human being? So God said, you know, I want the human being to think of itself differently than the other animals. I'm going to take the tail off. And so the question is, why is there a coccyx? Did the person ever have a tail? And what's the implication? If a human being has a tail, does it mean it's just another animal? Or by not having a tail, does that say something? So this is what Midrash does, is it jumps in and says, we have a question that cannot be answered. We bequeath you this question in the form of a story. Now tell us, what was the question we're trying to answer?
I feel like that made me think of how dreams. Because dreams to me are really powerful stories.
Right.
And what I love about dreams and working with dreams is that the big ones and the ones that you wake up from and are just kind of floored by, they don't have a single meaning. They're layered in ways that the meaning changes depending on who you're telling the dream to. It can open up new space. And over time, if you reflect on the dream the next day or the next month or 3 years down the road, the meaning can change. That's how I experienced that.
Okay.
And I feel like that's true with really big stories too.
Okay, so our the sages of my culture, mm-hmm, had their own take on dreams. They figured, you know, there's actually prefiguring what later psychiatrists would say and psychoanalysts, is that the subconscious is running wild while you're sleeping and will actually deal with things that you suppress during the day that will come out in some kind of symbolic language mixed together with all kind of gobbledygook that is in there also. So the idea is to separate what is meaningful from what is not. At the same time, they had a whole list of things that if this particular symbol or image appeared in a dream, it might be a good omen, it might be a bad omen. If it's a bad omen and you wake up and say, oh my God, my dream had X in it, then you might say, I'm going to take on a voluntary fast, I'm not going to eat or drink today, with the hopes that I can avert what I think this symbol means or what I've been told the symbol in the dream means. Hmm. So people took dreams seriously enough to figure that the dream is talking to them and trying to tell them something.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to talk a little bit about how stories shape us. And I'll tell a story I heard the anthropologist Wade Davis tell. It's kind of a story or an image. And he talked about how in traditional or indigenous cultures, trees were described and taught to children as relatives. You know, that, that a tree was kind of a member of the family. We relate to them. They, you know, they relate to us, and they're part of the family. And he talks about when I was growing up, I was taught that trees were lumber. And when you looked at a tree, you could think of it in so many board feet of lumber. And he talks about how much those two different ways of looking at the same thing shape a human being and then a culture.
So let's take an example from the five books of Moses. When you get to Deuteronomy and they describe the rules of warfare, they're actually going to talk about two different kinds of trees, ones that do not bear fruit and ones that do. The ones that don't are like lumber, but the ones who do you cannot damage. And it actually says, is the tree of the field a man that you should want to make war on it? That is, are you going to cut down this tree, which is food for you or food for your enemy, but is providing food? So there was this prohibition against cutting down trees that provided nourishment for people, animals, this kind of thing. So not to waste those trees and not to impose this kind of conqueror on it, the conqueror of nature.
And I'm curious how stories like that, they're often or maybe usually not working on an intellectual level only, at least, and maybe not even, that's not the main level that they work on. Like, most of us don't think of how we look at trees or even think that we have a story about trees, but actually we do. We all have these stories from our culture that shape us that we never think about, but that shape our perceptions of the world and shape, you know, how we encounter things. So I'm curious how you talk about stories shaping people. How do they work?
Well, for example, again, if you go into the Torah, which by common consent has 613 different commandments, 248 of them are positive commandments, thou shalt do, 365 are thou shalt not do. And I want to give you two of them, and you'll see how they are related. They happen to be the only commandments that have any kind of reward associated with them. One of them is the honoring of parents. And the other one that has the same reward is if you want the eggs from a nest on which the mother bird has been sitting and guarding the eggs, it says you must shoo the mother bird away before you take the eggs. No one ever talks about taking the mother bird, by the way. It's only the eggs. And what is the reward in order that your days be lengthened on the land that I'm going to give you is the reward. No other commandment has any reward. Both of them are about parents. So again, getting back to what we try to inculcate in our children in society is you teach them respect for the parent in the animal world, a parent in the physical world. So I would say that stories begin when we're very young and move out in a concentric circles from what's important to the child and into the broader society. But we start with these very fundamental things about who you respect, why you respect them, how you respect them.
So talk about truth in stories. We spoke about this a little bit before we came, and I was talking about how Maladoma Somme, who's from Burkina Faso and left his village and traditional culture, came to the West and then went back home and was talking to elders there about somehow fiction and nonfiction came up. And he said that the people in his village did not have those categories and were struggling to understand the difference between a story that was nonfiction and a story that was fiction. And he said the only way I could explain it to them was to say fiction stories are lies and nonfiction stories are true. But his deeper point was that when it came to stories, they didn't have that dichotomy that we do, that we want to put on stories. So what, for you, is, you know, what makes a story true?
We have to talk about two different kinds of truth.
Okay.
One is truth with a capital T, like an absolute truth. For example, the sanctity of life. Okay, and that's going to mean something different to everybody, right? Are you talking about animals, humans? You know, you're talking about the unborn child, you know, all this other stuff. And then you have a truth with a small t, which means that the facts may not be exactly right, but when you put us all together, there's something in there that we recognize as being authentic and real and teachable. So there's the capital T truth, the absolute truths that we agree upon as a society, that you better stop at the red octagon on the corner, right? Otherwise, it could be very, very bad. And then there are the smaller T's. Well, was there ever a creature that was half man and half horse? You know, is it important that you believe that the Minotaur really existed, or is it just a vehicle and a story?
Which is it?
Well, you mean is it real, or is it? I mean, or is it okay? It is real in that every human being has within it an animal, at the same time, and in fact, you can even see in people the different animals that you would describe them as if they were graceful, for example, right? You saw them running, you know, and you said, "Gosh, you know, that's a poetry in motion, just like the leopard, or you know, or something like that." So we are part animal and part human. The way that we describe it, it may be an abstraction of what we feel is true about humans.
That made me think of a story that you read. I don't know if you've read Vine Deloria Jr., any of his work. He was a Lakota author and lawyer and thinker, and a really challenging thinker. And he talks about, he's talking about dreams, and he says, you know, one of the different, and I might butcher this a little bit. So, it's in a book called The World We Used to Live In, if anybody wants to find it and look at the reference. But he says, you know, in our culture, if a bear comes to us in a dream, we don't immediately try and symbolize that bear and say, you know, what does that bear mean? Or, you know, and start psychoanalyzing. We take the bear in the dream on the bear's own terms, and we receive, you know, the message from the bear as a message from the bear. We don't have this layer of abstraction that Western culture has, which I think is really, to me, that's a really provocative thought, and it
right.
challenges our
by
categories.
The way, you find both of these in the Torah again,
uh-huh.
is that you have a pharaoh with two similar dreams, and none of his interpreters can help him understand them until Joseph comes along and says, well, you know, the seven fat cows are 7 good years, the seven lean cows are 7 years of famine, right? You've got, you know, fat ears of corn, and you've got, you know skinny grain. You understand that in that case, that is where the cows are being used, the corn is being used as a symbol. And then you have the donkey of Balaam that talks to him and reprimands him for not seeing this angel standing in the way, getting ready to kill both of them. And Balaam is beating the you-know-what out of this poor donkey.
We're going to be back in a moment. We'll pick up maybe at the poor donkey. This is Joe Orso, and I'm here with Saul Prombaum on Conversations. Back in a moment. We're back on WDRT. Show is Conversations, and this is Joe Orso with Saul Prombaum. You were talking about a donkey.
Right, so I was talking about the story of Balaam, the Gentile prophet for hire, who could put the whammy on anybody that God gave him permission to put the whammy on, and yet he couldn't see something his own donkey I could see kind of making fun of him. The question is, are there such things as talking donkeys? Is it this donkey that reprimanded him? No one has ever heard a talking donkey before. So the way that the sages dealt with this is that on the twilight, that is at the end of the 6 days of creation, God created a bunch of things and kept them in a warehouse ready to go. One of them, cue the talking donkey for this story, or bring in the special rainbow after the flood in the time of Noah, because these were special, like, one-time items that would appear. And this was the rabbi's way of saying it was true insofar as God covered that, knowing all of history that was going to unfold. God created these things and left them in the big storehouse, waiting to come out on that moment, in that moment on the stage when it was appropriate for them to come out.
As miracles?
Well, we would call them miracles, mm-hmm. but you know, the rabbis would say there are no talking donkeys. This was a special one that God created for this story. I mean, this presupposes the omniscient storyteller, right? Knowing that everything that is going to happen as it unfolds. And so the rabbi said, if you believe in an all-powerful, all-knowing God, then God knows when this donkey that talks is going to be needed in the narrative.
Well, so I want to shift a little bit.
I like donkeys.
Okay, we can keep talking about donkeys. Right. Do you have any more donkey stories before we shift?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Just Rafi, remember, me donkey he, me donkey ha. Me donkey, you know, nibbling on a bed of straw or something, or sleeping on a bed of straw. Okay. We're done with that. I got out of my system now.
Okay. So my daughter, Sephora, often asks for a story, just straight up, can you tell me a story, Daddy? Or can you tell me a story, Mommy? And she's 4 years old, and what's been a gift for me is to see any kind of story, how she just locks onto it. And she just needs, loves stories. And you tell her a story, and then, can you tell me that again? And it doesn't matter what kind of story. Last night when I was brushing her teeth, I told her a story about a tooth and a tongue that were walking through the forest looking for a mouth. Finally, they found a slow walker, which is what she calls older folks, and who... you know, was looking for a tongue and a tooth, and she was enthralled. It was not a great story. I was scrambling. But the point is, it doesn't almost matter to her. Her eyes just lock on whenever we tell any kind of story. Along with that, I really feel my failure as a good storyteller. And so I just want to kind of open up that part of our conversation is,
well, I think that a four-year-old has something that all of us as adults have lost, and that is the capacity for magical thinking, and to be able to just weave it into everything else that's going on in our lives. I lament the loss of that, and one of the reasons it is so hard to come up with stories is because our thinking is too concrete, and we don't let our thoughts just go out and trying to make connection with other thoughts and just let it happen the way good writers do. You know, I mean, there are writers who will tell you that when they're writing a book, they'll have a clamshell. They know how the book begins and ends, but what happens in the middle to their characters, they won't even tell you that they know what's going to happen until it comes off of their fingers through the keyboard or whatever it is. We keep our guard up too much. We don't let the stories develop. We're afraid of saying the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
We're afraid of sanitizing stories. Kids do well with just about any story as long as you're there to explain it to them and that you don't give them things that you know are inherently frightening and then just leave it like a horror movie or something to think about later. So kids love stories. People love stories. But unfortunately, the story is killed for adults because we're not told stories anymore. We're said, see that story over there? They wrote it down in a book. Now you go read that book and there's the story. Or you want to hear a joke? No, you don't want to hear a joke anymore. You don't have the patience to listen. Go on the internet and read that joke. And you'll see it. So we have killed storytelling by first writing them down. If you want to lose something in a culture, write it down and it'll get lost. It's only in a culture that preserves an oral tradition, and kids love oral tradition. They're really typically pre-reading, and so what they hear is how they get their stories. This is human nature.
What's that about? Why is that story? And I totally feel you. That is so true. She loves the story told. What is that about? The difference between a read story or reading a story and telling, or you know, hearing a story told.
Okay, hearing a story told means that you can vary a story, and the person listening, if they've heard the story enough, could say, "Dad, you left out the part about the bear," or something like that. And he said, "Oh, yes, 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 there was a bear in the story." So those stories are elastic. They're plastic. You can mold them into whatever you want. The story on the page becomes a wooden story, if you will. And what happens, by the way, to kids who only get stories from books is they'll see the ways the pages are flipped. The next stage will be, "Mom, I'm going to read you the story," where they're not reading, they're just taking what they've memorized off the page as they flip it and tell their version of what happened on the page. When they become readers, then they're very proud that they can read the story. But the story is a fixed, dead story that we are creatures that depend on what we take in through our ears when we're young, because we want to survive, and we look to our parents to tell us things that will help us survive or understand the world better, or remind us that they love us so that we have security when we're growing up and don't have to worry about things.
So this morning, Sipora woke up, came downstairs, and we were cuddling on the couch. And one of the first things she said to me was about this story that we read her. We're really careful about what stories we tell, and what stories we read, and what stories she hears when adults are around, because they shape kids so
okay,
intensely.
Okay, so let me ask you, what age were you exposed to Grimm's fairy tales?
Hardly ever.
But I was exposed. That was the usual fare.
Mm-hmm.
They were frightening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, there's good conversation about when to frighten children. But anyway, we're careful about it. But there's this story that we read her, and there's a moment where a prince chops off the head of a dragon. So she came down this morning and she said, "Dad, you know that part where that prince chops off the head of the dragon?" I was like, "Yeah." And she said, "I don't think he should have done that. I think somebody should chop off the head of the prince." And
as punishment?
Yeah. And so I said, "Well, but who's going to chop off the head of the person who chopped off the head of the prince?" And I don't know if that made sense to her. So then we started talking about it, and I said,
"Progressive revenge."
Right. Yeah. And so it's interesting. And I was trying to find my way with this story now that she was asking a question about. And I said, "Well, I wonder why she wrote it like that." And she knows this is an Elsa Besko story. And she says, "You know, I think Elsa Besko, that's a bad page, and maybe I want to tear it." And I said, "Well, I wonder what else, I wonder if the prince could have done something else." And her mom was hearing this. Adrienne came down and said, "You know, Sipora, why don't you think about a different story there? Like, what else could the prince have done instead of chopping off the head of the dragon? If you want, then we can start telling that story when we read the book." And Sipora didn't say anything else. So now we'll see where that goes. But I appreciate it.
Or she may say skip the page.
Or she may say skip the page. Or she might tear it out. But I like the experience of having a story alive in that way, which, you know, where it feels fluid and you can engage it. And I, anyway, I don't know. for, and it feels like that happens when you're telling stories in a way that doesn't happen when you're just passively reading a story.
That's
or
right.
being read a story. So how do we get that back? How do we get back a more oral storytelling culture? Because it's also not easy. I feel like a lot of my stories just, they're not great. I mean, she appreciates them, but as she gets older, you know, I don't feel like a skilled storyteller. How do you get that back?
Well, I'll tell you, I would refer you, I forgot the name of the priest that he worked with, but there's a rabbi, Mark Gelman. He wrote a book called Does God Have a Big Toe? And basically, these are modern midrashic kinds of stories. There's a story that I'd have you look at, maybe even read to your daughter, called The First Hamburger. And by the end, it will tell you what the story is about. It won't even leave it open to why it is. I will tell you that Noah has this craving for a hamburger, and the nemesis in the story tells him how to get one, and he has one. And the story is used to explain why animals don't talk to people anymore, because an animal had to die in order to give Noah his hamburger, and no animal had died before that. So it's a very interesting, interesting story. Why don't animals talk to people anymore? If God brought all the animals in the world to see if Adam could find a mate among the animals, maybe he talked to them, right?
I feel like we suffer from different kinds of losses around stories in this culture. And one is our loss of, you know, just like oral storytelling skill. And another is that is like a really severe loss of stories. So my own experience is I grew up with stories around, you know, I grew up Catholic, and there was stories told in that tradition, and there was stories around the Eucharist that I deeply value and honor and respect, and have people in my life who those stories work for. They shape them in beautiful, profound ways, and I totally honor those stories. I have a love for them because they're kind of a familial tradition. At the same time, if I'm trying to be authentic and honest with my own experience, those stories stopped working for me.
Why?
And I don't know.
Okay.
But
there are stories out there that will work for you. And I had to tell you, you maybe heard of an organization called Seed Savers.
Yeah.
Okay. Seed Savers is going to make sure that, you know, certain plants, vegetables, and things are going to be around, God forbid, if we needed them. There are people out there collecting stories the same way, stories from all over the world. And I think that you will find that even if some of these stories that you have learned are not working for you, you will say, my God, I heard that story once told in a different way. I didn't know that it came from there. That we're collecting stories, we are documenting them so that people can reference them and tell them, because there is a hunger for stories. People do want them, not just kids, but grown-ups.
We do, for sure. But reintegrating them into our lives. So, you know, I think it's a really important thing for a people to have a creation story, for instance.
Yeah.
To know where we come from, what our lineage, you know, in time to our ancestors and to the spirit world looks like, and how that shapes us. And I think when you're in a functioning culture, that story just lives in you and shapes your identity in many ways, in that as well as, you know, a multitude of other stories. But I find in my life, and I think others who I know, we don't have those stories that shape our identity in the same way. And so there's like an alienation that happens because of that.
You need to go to a storytellers conference.
Oh.
I mean, honestly.
Really?
When you hear people who are trying to make a living as storytellers, they make their stories so tasty. And they even tell you this story is from, you know, such and such a place. And you know, there are books out there that would not have become bestsellers without stories. So, for example, there's a book that's been around a few years. It's called Women Who Run with the Wolves.
Oh, Adrienne's reading that right now.
Okay.
This
book has stories that the author, Estes is her last name, she is unpacking these stories to explain why these stories are important for women's culture. Okay. So we are using story all of the time to make our points. And if not for story, the things that we tell people would be too direct, sometimes too painful. You have to wrap a message in a story.
How do we find our way back? Is it just reading books and going to storyteller conferences? How do we reintegrate those like into our families and our lives in a way where we're not just retelling them, but where we're taking them in?
Okay, so here's the thing. If you take a story from a book and you make it your own, you're not retelling it. You're going to begin changing it. You're going to maybe inflect it differently, put some emotion in at a certain point. It's the way that you interpret the story that gives it life. Let me give you an interesting bit. You know, in my culture, which always relied on rabbis to give answers to difficult questions, about 400 years ago, a question came from North Africa to the leading rabbis. They wanted to know, can you take a Torah scroll, which has these letters in it that have no vowels or punctuation, can you write in the punctuation, the pronunciation of the words, and the singing marks? They go in it. You know what answer came back? The answer is you can't. That is, the scroll is only a corpse. It is your job to breathe the spirit of life into those letters with the pronunciation, with the singing that you have stored in your brain, and bring those words back to life again. So the idea is to find a story that means something to you, put yourself in the story, and then tell it to somebody. That's how it begins. Hmm. Or personalize the story by changing the characters, changing the setting, and say, my God, this story describes something that happened to Aunt Matilda or something, and this is a great story. Or I remember something like this happening in my own family, and it will help you recall things. Memories that you, stories will reconnect you.
And they'll take on a different charge, I think, when you take it in that way that you're talking about. It triggered a memory for me of listening to a Franciscan sister tell the story of the road to Emmaus, where the disciples, after Jesus passes over, are walking. They didn't recognize him, and then all of a sudden they recognize him at a moment. And that's another one of those stories that I had heard many times and was not deeply meaningful and was kind of a dead story. And when she read it, she didn't even talk about the story. It was just how she read it with her presence, that when she read those words for the first time that I could not mimic, but that story like floored me. And it was all related,
well,
I think, to what
you're
saying.
Well, you were receptive to the story. That is, you were in a setting with that sister who was reading the story, and you had opened yourself to what she was talking about.
But she also had that story was working in her in a profound way,
right?
Where I think
that made
it was
tasty
also,
for you.
She was bringing a presence to it, which changed the story. So we're gonna be right back after a brief pause. We're back on Conversations on WDRT here with my friend Saul Prombaum, and we've been talking about stories. And Saul, I wonder if you could just tell us a story.
Well, I'll tell you. My father passed away in December of last year. And as these many months have gone by, I realize what a huge influence he was in my life, and I find myself telling more stories about what I saw him do or what happened to him. So I'd like to share a couple of them with you. First, the most recent one that happened about 3 weeks before he died at the age of 94, and then one that was from earlier in my life. The one that was more recent, I was in the car with him in Chicago, and we were driving, and we come to an intersection, and there's one of these guys with the cardboard signs with the handwritten, you know, basically a down and outer, we would call them, as, you know, someone who needs money. And I'm thinking, all these people around the United States must get their signs printed at the same place and, you know, stand on the corners and are trained in how to do this. So my father says to me, "You're not going to give him something?" I said, "Dad, I said, this guy makes a better living than I do. You know, he stands here all day." And people, he said, "But you should give him something." Of course, I said, "Why?" He said, "Because you will get out of the habit of giving. He may be a scam artist, but what if he's not? He's going to walk by him." So I didn't, by the way. And then after my father died, about 2 weeks later, when I came back to Chicago to clean out his apartment, I go by the same intersection, and there's the same guy, and I roll down the window and give him a dollar. I said, "See, Dad?" Okay. So this is a story of a teaching that I received, something that happened in my own life that had had some meaning. Then from earlier, I once witnessed my father. I must have been about 8 or 9, where we were outside. It was in the summer. We're on the south side of Chicago, and this tough we would call them a greaser today, you know, was actually trying to rob a woman's purse right there on the street. And my father saw it, and he ran over and starts yelling at this kid to let go of the bag. Now, never thinking, does this guy have a knife, whatever it is. Now, those were the days before people had central air. Okay, so you have, you know, windows open. So people start looking out their windows. My father says, "Call the police." Yells up to one of the windows. The guy's laughing. "Oh, they won't call." "No," he says, "call the police. You're staying here now." And the police came. And this had a lot of influence on me. Is my father got involved in things. And you can't ignore these stories as they come back to you. That is, sometimes they are suppressed, and you remember because you're trying to remember the person. Now, having told you this, I want to tell you my favorite lacrosse story. Okay, I'm in Walgreens on West Avenue, the one by St. Francis, now Mayo. And they are the king of impulse selling, which is when you get to the checkout, you want to have two candy bars for a dollar. It so happened that the cashier, who works at another Walgreens now, her name is Candy, she said, "You want to get these two candy bars for a dollar." So I said, "Well, I'm going to buy them, not for me, but as I take the candy, I pivot on my heels to the stranger behind me, but I know this man knows what to do with these candy bars." And this Afro-American man looks at me like, "Are you nuts?" I said, "But you do know, don't you?" And I said, "Would you please accept these as a gift?" He said, "I accept them." And in the parking lot, he called to me and said, "My daughters will enjoy these, and I thank you." I had, within the next 2 hours, lunch downtown at Digger's on 3rd Street on a snowy, slushy day. And when we came out, the person I was with said, "Look in the snow. There's a dollar bill." The dollar bill was returned the same day for maybe another act of kindness. Hmm. My whole life, by the way, is filled with these kinds of personal stories. So I think that some of the best stories come out of our own lives. And in fact, you'll find that when you tell Sephora stories, she wants to hear about her father's life or her mother's life.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Or grandpa or grandma. And you will be doing her a service through the great oral tradition. By the way, before we leave, I want to say Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Prize laureate, said, "The reason that God created people is because God likes stories. And every person is a story." In fact, we have a special burial prayer that started out as a prayer when you bury a scholar. It was used basically saying their book is closed now. But this is not democratic. It said everyone has some kind of learning that they've acquired. You should say this burial prayer, the burial kaddish, for everybody when their book is closed.
Stories are really important. when we think about death as well. Like you said, Sipor loves to hear stories about Poppy and her grandparents. And it's really helpful because she was with my grandpa when he passed over, and so we tell her stories from those moments and those days, and she asks for stories about him. And for me, it's really helpful in remembering Poppy and keeping him here with us and praying for him and all of that. And it seems like around, with death and passing over, that stories become important in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Stories do. I mean, for example, if you're going to tell stories about a parent who is gone, it's because anyone who's ever lost a parent or a loved one, it's hard for them to explain what they've lost when this person dies. And that part they shared goes in the ground mm-hmm. with them. And you can't explain. It's like a part of you has been ripped out. Hmm. And so by telling the story, you keep them alive. Now, in Hebrew, the verb lizkor, to remember, has three components. One is to concentrate on the thing that you're trying to remember. Remember it, but then proclaim it. Is that the only way a story lives is by the mouth. The mouth to the ear of another, the mouth to your own ear, hearing the story again. So this is very important. Now, I want to also mention to you that there are two Hebrew words. One is a sefer, book, from a verb that means to count, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Every story is an account of something that starts one place, maybe has a middle, and then an end. Is that so stories have boundaries, and they have a sequence to them. There's another kind of story, and that's from the verb lahagid, to tell, that is different than sipor, story, different than a sipor. Sipor is a bird, but a sipor is a story, an accounting. A lahagid, to tell, as in Passover Haggadah, Passover table service at the Seder, telling of the Exodus from Egypt, is a confrontational story. Hmm. Because the central message of that book that you're trying to do is, in every generation, a person is supposed to see themselves as if they personally came out of Egypt. Hmm. Now, Egypt means in Hebrew, Mitzrayim, Mitzar, a narrow, tight place. In every generation, we are creating new forms of enslavements that are putting us into tight spots. And then we have to figure out how to get out of them in every generation. So you have to have a story that says, hey, wake up. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's not just being passive, but it's actually being asking the person who is listening to do something based on what you're telling them, what the story is asking.
There's a great story that comes to mind that speaks to that, and it's I read it in a book by Derek Jensen, and he's talking about a woman who had been chained herself to a tree in a forest and was with others trying to protect a forest from being logged, and her grandmother didn't understand why she was doing it, and she didn't understand why it was so meaningful for her. And the woman said to her grandmother, she said, "Grandma, imagine if they were going to drive a bulldozer through St. John the Divine. What would you do?" And her grandmother responded to her, "Next time, you don't sit down when you're chained to that tree, you stand up." And so she helped her grandmother, translate, or she brought that story forward, or she brought her story into her grandmother. And that way of bringing stories across generations and breathing life into them is like, yeah, I guess that's a challenge. And when you do it though, it's powerful.
Right.
It's powerful. But it's hard to carry those stories through.
One of the hardest stories of what we call psychodramas mm-hmm. is that, sometimes you have people who have some acting ability adopt a character in a circle of people as they have to become an alcoholic, a drug addict who believes that they're beyond hope, and you're then given an opportunity to talk to the people in the circle. And you keep pushing them away. No, this is not going to help me, or this kind of thing. So where you actually turn a story into a real life situation and ask people to step outside of themselves and to interact with the character. So these are all stories.
So I'm going to tell one of my favorite stories that you gave to my family is when we were at Sapor's Blessing. And I'll say that your wife, Karen, named our daughter Sapor. We were looking for names, and Karen found Sapor for us. And Sapor means bird in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And we also liked, which Karen explained to us, that Sapor means story. So the name contained that. And I remember when at her blessing, we were standing around and you talked about, maybe you could tell, because I think you know what I'm not sure. Do you know where I'm going? So you talked about how they didn't know the scholars didn't know exactly where, you know, how the word Sapora came to represent bird, but there was conjecture that the sound is related to the noise that birds make. Sip, 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 sip.
Yes.
And so you said to her, so whenever you hear birds speaking or singing, know that they're calling out your name, which now we tell to her. I don't know if I have that right or not.
No, you have it right.
But we tell that to her, and the meaning of that, I think, is really important, or the feeling of that is really important for us as a.
You know, if I saw Sapora, mm-hmm. I would actually tell her the story of a real squirrel, by the way, lives in Savannah, Georgia, by the name of Peanut, that adopted a family and became an inside squirrel, living with the family. Until it got to a certain age, met a girl squirrel outside and didn't want to come back in the house, but came back to visit. The point being is that stories and reality, truth, they meld together. And, you know, I could show her a video of little Peanut eating an almond, which would probably, you know, destroy her, given that it's not a peanut, but maybe it has a peanut allergy. Okay. So the point being is that everything is a story. Everything can become a story if you let it. Your own life is a story.
Can stories misshape us or distort us?
I have thought about. I know you asked that question of me once, and I feel that we have, by nature, this. I wouldn't say misshape us. I think that the human being is born with a curiosity and an attraction to things that scare us, is that we don't run away from them. We get close and we get scared again by them. You know, so for example, I remember in the Museum of Science and Industry on the South Side of Chicago growing up, they had fetuses in jars at various stages. I was frightened of them when I was a little kid. I said, that's a real person in there? I don't know what happened to them. You would never show that again today. You wouldn't show it.
So it's not the stories that necessarily misshape us, but just that we're attracted to.
Right, and I kept talking about it. I remember talking about it all the time. You remember the, you know, the mm-hmm. jars with the babies in them, the mm-hmm. dead babies.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Tell us another story.
Okay. I will tell you the story of my son Alex, and when he was out with his mother one day on a summer day, and he was 4 years old. Alex is now 34. Hmm. And Karen was, you know, being her goofy free self, and there's some music on and she's dancing, and Alex grabs onto her leg and whispers to her, "Mom, you're embarrassing me." And she looked down at him and said, "And I am embarrassed by your embarrassment." The child looks up at her like, "What just happened?"
Huh.
Okay, that's a story for parents. Okay.
Wow. So we're coming to the end of the show here.
I'm so glad we've had this time together.
Okay. No, that's what I was going to ask, if there's any song you want to sing or anything you want to do to bring us to a close.
Well before I found myself lapsing into Buddy Hackett, so I just feel like this is the proper way to end it. And I'm going to introduce my friend Archie. Archie, come over here. Would you jump me up there now, meathead?
And I saw those are my friends I brought along today. They just wanted to say hi.
Are there any others in the room?
Well, you know, Halloween is coming, so Boris Karloff is here. And then, of course, Julia Child is going to make her favorite recipe.
No, all these people are leaving with me. I just didn't want to scare the engineer here. Okay, is that we come together and we leave together?
Oh, that's good. What about with stories? Is there any final words you can leave us with when we think about stories?
That is, go to the library, find anthologies of stories, read them, and then pick out your favorite stories and ask yourself why. What was it about the story? And then ask yourself, could I tell this story to somebody without using the book as a crutch? Hmm. Tell stories and get away from our smartphones, get away from too much FaceTime with the computer, rehumanize society through stories.
Amen. Thank you so much for
Having me.
For being here. This has been Joe Orso on Conversations with my good friend Saul Prombaum. And
my knight in shining armor, Joe. Okay.
Likewise. All right. Okay. Thanks, Saul.
Thank you.